You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
Our guest today on HeadX is Arthur Levine, who's a scholar of higher education at New York University's Steinhardt Institute for Higher Education Policy. He's also a senior fellow and president emeritus of the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation, and is a president emeritus of Columbia University's Teachers College, a fine track record of exemplary leadership in our field in great institutions. As well as serving in that way, he's written extensively about higher education for an extended period, and most recently came to my attention for being a co-author of a particularly relevant recent book, I could still call it recent, with Scott Van Pelt, a title called The Great Upheaval. Now, this book was written early during the pandemic period and published in the middle of it, and it takes three different perspectives on Arthur and Scott's views of why change is taking place in American and global higher education institutions. It does so by looking back at the history of our universities and how they've developed in the way that they have. But it also looks forward to forecasts and predictions of change in universities and higher education institutions that are being made by a number of people from current trends in demand and practices in those places. But the bit about their book that really caught my attention is the way it also looks sideways at other sectors where disruption has occurred, why it's happened, and the form that it's taken. And Arthur and Scott make these sideways analyses to explore the extent to which similar disruption to what has happened elsewhere might be experienced in our sector, and if so, what its implications would be. Look, I'm not an expert on the book because I didn't write it, and I'm doing a lot of talking about it. I think it makes a great contribution to our understanding of the change taking place in global higher education. I congratulate you on having written it, Arthur, and welcome to the HeadX podcast.
I'm pleased to be here, and let me add that I thought you did a better job describing my book than I did.
You really are too kind. And look, that was me trying to summarize what was probably many hours over years of work into a brief summary of a fantastic contribution. And look, I'm going to ask you lots more questions about that, Arthur, straight after this message from our sponsors.
Short on resources to enhance your university's online learning objectives? OES's collaborative approach ensures program success while offering flexibility across disciplines. Our tailored solutions uphold academic rigour and your reputation. Choose OES for adaptable, high-quality online learning experiences.
So, Arthur, back to your book. And before we get into the details of it, tell us a little bit about you, the scholar, because you've been a scholar and an innovator in higher education for a long time. You've made, in my view, an outstanding contribution to our understanding of the change taking place right now. And how did that all come about? Can you tell us more about what your journey in academic life has been and what shapes the views that you now hold about what the future offers to us?
Gladly. What I'd say is that my interest in higher education began in college. I was the first member of my family to go. I went in the late 1960s and encountered all of the activism of that period and decided I would really like to work at a college. And I was real active in student politics and decided not only that, someday I would like to be a college president. And the rest of my journey followed from there, which is to say, after college, a friend and I wrote a book about academic policy. We sat on the curriculum committee in college, which turned out to be a matter of everybody expressing their opinions on what worked and what didn't work. And we decided, why don't we do a study and find out what really does work and really doesn't work? And that book led to my first job, which was at the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching. I worked for a fellow named Clark Kerr, who had created the University of California system. And then after Clark retired, by the way, it was a wonderful job. They paid me to write books. So that, after that, I went to work for Ernest Boyer and at the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching. And then I'd done a lot of consulting. I'd done a lot of writing. And I had the conceit of youth. And working with colleges and universities, I decided, you know, I can do this better than the people who are there already. So I decided it's time to become a college president. And I became president of a small, private, foundering liberal arts college and had a chance to try my ideas there about curriculum change and how you could essentially lead a college into the future based upon a distinctive curriculum. After that, I went to Harvard, and at Harvard, I headed their higher ed programs and had programs for college presidents, deans, vice presidents, deputy chancellors over the summer. And then I went to Columbia as president of Teachers College, and then went to the Woodrow Wilson Foundation. And therein ends my career.
Well, I'm sure it hasn't ended there, Arthur. It just brings us up to the present day. But what a pedigree. Of the opportunity to work with Clark Kerr and Ernest Boyer is one thing. To getting paid for it and the chance to write books sounds like the dream job to me. But
it absolutely was. It was a wonderful, wonderful job.
And look, you've written some fantastic books, which I'm sure it hasn't been easy, but I can't imagine being given a better starting point than that pedigree to be able to do some great work, being inspired by the shoulders of giants that we all strive for the opportunity to stand upon and look at these issues. And the book that I came across of the Great Upheaval, I find it a fascinating insight into what you saw happening in US universities as we were in the early part of the pandemic period, I assume. I wonder if you can tell us, bringing us up to recent times, what caused you to write that particular book with Scott? And how did you go about researching and writing it?
The easy part is explaining Scott. Scott was my research associate at the Woodrow Wilson Foundation. He was a student at Teachers College. And when I retired, I said, Scott, here's the deal. I can't afford a research assistant anymore, but I can take on a co-author. So become my co-author. And he did. The book essentially brings together three methods of analysis I've used throughout my career. And the first is historical, essentially looking for foundation stones that we can tie ongoing events to. Say, that's a lot like X. The second was, I've always used demographics, economics, and technology to think about the future. And finally, I used other industries. So those were the three approaches. One was comparative, one was historical, and the third was projecting current trends forward. And I had no idea whether they'd work together, whether they'd yield the same results. And I was shocked when they did.
Well, it's a beautiful, beautiful way that unfolds through the three books and the way that it crystallizes in a fantastic bit of synthesis in the summary. And let's have a walk through some of those different components then and that process. Because as you've said, the book begins with for me, working in a part of the world with a shorter history of the development of universities, a comparatively fascinating analysis of that historical development in the American context. And for the benefit of a global audience on this podcast, summarize what the main features of that American university history have been, as you now and how you believe they are impacting on what might happen to those universities in the future as we sit in the current day.
You know, for I've also presented this in other countries. It works best in the global north, where population is decreasing and it's facing many of the challenges that American higher education is facing. But let me go back to the historical piece you asked me about. And what I'd say is the most interesting thing to me, and it's relevant to the present, is that higher education changed during the Industrial Revolution in exactly the same phases as changing now. At the start of the Industrial Revolution, American higher education was a set of institutions that taught the trivium and quadrivium for the most part, and were tied to the Middle Ages. And in the course of a century, they became universities, they became technical schools, they became community colleges, two-year colleges, they became every variation of higher education that exists in the present. It was a revolution. And the stages it went through were these. The first one was complaints. Higher education is too expensive. Higher education is out of date. Higher education has lost track of careers and work. And the state of Connecticut, one of the 50 US states, refused to continue to fund Yale because of all those problems. And what then happened was higher education, during this extraordinary criticism, acted much as it did now. Its reaction was denial. We hear what you're saying, but you couldn't be more wrong. The third stage, you can only get along with denial for so long. And the third stage was a whole bunch of experiments with every aspect of higher education you can think of: the price, the curriculum, the staffing, the calendar. Everything was up for grabs. And then came a period in which, based upon those experiments, we went into a fourth stage. And that was the evolution of models that came out of the experiment. Brand new institutions, places like Johns Hopkins University. And what Johns Hopkins did was it pioneered for the United States the research university. It pioneered to the United States the graduate school. And then there were places like Cornell, which was a land-grant university. And that meant it combined the liberal arts with technical and mechanical education. Cornell's motto became any person, any study. It even admitted women. Mm-hmm. Then there were institutions like MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, that came along and said, what we really need to be doing is science education. And we really need to be studying technology in a way that no universities in this country were. And then finally, late in the cycle, came something called the junior college. And the junior college has today become the community college or two-year college, which enrolls a majority of entering students in American higher education. Okay, so what happens with this model is we go into a fifth stage. And the fifth stage is dissemination, diffusion. And what I analogize it to was what we term the wild, wild west in the United States. There was a lawlessness, a rulelessness, anomie. And what happened was that all of these ideas were adopted by different universities in different fashions. So, for example, the University of Michigan and Harvard couldn't agree on how long a course was. How long did a course take? How many courses did you need to get or a diploma? How many, blah, 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 blah. And that brought us into a sixth stage. And that stage was We needed to tame this monster somehow and get some common definitions. So the first thing we did was create a police force, a sheriff, to oversee this. And that was called accreditation.
Yes.
And the next thing we did was we needed some way to unify this. We needed a common accounting system. And that was the credit unit, the Carnegie unit. And that became the norm for institutions in the United States and also many abroad. And then the final thing we did was we took the standardized stuff and integrated it all and created the modern university. What's happening now is we're going through the same stages.
Mm-hmm.
We're somewhere between stage three and stage four. Stage three, the experimentation. Stage four, the creation of models. And those would be places like Southern New Hampshire University. There'd be places like Western Governors University. Mm-hmm. And there'd be places like Arizona State University. And some providers of post-secondary education that aren't even universities, like Coursera, which is an online MOOC platform, massive open online courses.
It's fascinating to listen to you, Arthur, and I found it so insightful to read that part of the book, in that I haven't been a big student of the history of our universities. I've read a number of books that Michael Crow has written about different waves of American higher education. I'm sure you're familiar with them, as I know you've worked together for a long time. But listening to you and reading that part of the book, I can't believe how much value a historical analysis provides to what we have going on now. And I wonder, for leaders of universities around the world listening to this interview, what encouragement would you give to them themselves to understand the history of the development of universities in America and elsewhere to better understand the sort of dynamics that they're operating in at the moment? Is that important for them too?
I think it's critical. I headed an institute at Harvard on the goal was to prepare new college presidents. They'd just been named college presidents. And they asked, what's the most important thing a college president can study? And by and large, these were all Americans. And my answer was American history. Huh. The reason being, anything that's happening today, you can find roots into the past. For example, one of the big issues in the United States now is artificial intelligence and virtual reality. Well, it turns out during the Industrial Revolution, we had the same thing. Brand new methods of instruction were created. And lo and behold, they looked like those things that were prized by a national analog industrial economy. And they fixed the amount of time that students studied. They fixed the process by which students studied. And it resembled an assembly line, which was one of the most effective technologies that came out of the Industrial Revolution. Well, today, what's happening is that we're trying to essentially make higher education more compatible with a global digital knowledge economy. And the same way that institutions in the past focused on standardizing time and process, today those are variables or becoming variables. And what we're focused on is standardizing outcomes. And it turns out that artificial intelligence is as powerful as any, probably more so, and as central to the movement as were all the instructional changes that occurred during the Industrial Revolution. So the reality is you can find background, you can find precedent for almost anything happening today. One of the hottest issues in America right now is something called diversity, equity, and inclusion. And that's in a political crosshairs. with conservatives and Republican governors really clamping down on it. The governor of Florida, for example, made that illegal in colleges and universities, and in fact took over the most radical of one, reappointing its board and changing its program. Well, DEI isn't new.
No.
During the Industrial Revolution, the exact same thing happened. And over the exact same kinds of issues, which was there were political issues, there were scientific issues, and there were economic issues that people were getting fired for. So, for example, at some university named Stanford in California.
I think I've heard of that one.
One professor criticized the railroads that were being built and criticized that it was using cheap Chinese labor and said it ought to be municipally owned. Well, it turned out the governor of California during that period was a guy named Leland Stanford, who had created the railroads. But maybe even more important, the university was named after his departed son, Leland Stanford Junior University. Lo and behold, that professor was made to resign. And there were countless other cases just like that. The other thing that happened was there was a New York Times front page story. And the front page story was about an ideological war going on at Yale between the president and a sociology professor who was teaching Spencer, Darwinian theory. Well, Yale was a religious institution. And this went all the way to his board of trustees. The professor refused to stop teaching it, renowned professor. The president wouldn't give up. And finally, what happened was the professor decided not to teach that course. And the board decided that the issue should be dropped. But imagine, front page of the New York Times.
That's incredible.
The issues are the same.
So, you, I mean, if you didn't know that from studying history, you'd think that new technologies now and new focus on, you know, freedom of speech and academic freedom in our universities was something that we were encountering from the first time. You wouldn't understand the lessons from history about how to deal with them, would you? But look, I might take that as a bit of a segue point in moving to the second part of the book, because you've very clearly articulated why historical analysis is valuable and important for scholars of higher education thinking about the future and leaders trying to take institutions into it. But your second part of your book looks at lessons from that might be drawn from forecasts that are being made of the future of our universities, if I put it like that. And I'm sure some of the speculation that you observed at the time when you wrote the book in, I presume, 2020 and published it in 2021, has, things are happening so fast now that some of that has presumably already started to occur. And I wonder if you might start us off by updating us on the great upheaval before the next book comes out, Arthur, in how much of what you saw might happen in 2021 do you believe has started to occur in your analysis of the data and of occurrences that have happened since?
I'm trying to figure out how to say this nicely. We were pretty close to accurate. I can't think of any major departure in terms of what we wrote and what's happened. But bear in mind, we're only talking about a period of 3 years. How much off could you be?
They've been a big 3 years, though, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. They really have been. And we're starting to see some of the things that Scott and I talked about become more and more important. Demographics. What's going to happen is, or what started happening is, the number of people living in the Northeast United States, the Midwestern United States, and the Middle Atlantic states, so the Northeast and Midwest, are declining in terms of number of people of college age. And the consequences that we're seeing institutions close at larger rates than we've ever seen before. And the guesstimates are that by the time all this is over, we will have seen 15 to 20% of all colleges close. And for the most part, they're likely to be small, private, low selectivity institutions with small, with limited financial resources. And we're also seeing the population age. All those things were inevitable in 1921. 2021.
More so in 2021 than 1921, I imagine, at least in widespread consciousness. But goodness knows how they're going to start looking in 2031. And look, you were a scholar that wanted to become a president and did so, and now you're using your scholarship to understand the future again. If you were the president that started out on their journey of presidency, and for our modern day presidents of universities, vice chancellors of universities, how do they keep on top of forecasts of the future when they're so immersed in the day-to-day nature of their role? And how important is that for them to do so, to be able to lead their institution effectively, do you think?
I think it's very, very important. The simple reality is that change happens behind our back in the world. We're busy doing what we've always done. And it worked pretty well in the past. And then all of a sudden, it doesn't seem to work anymore. And it's very important for college and university presidents, vice chancellors, that they keep this issue in front of them. And there are any number of ways to do this. One is keep reading, go to conferences, hear what's happening, read. Read outside your field. Read about what's going on in other fields. The kinds of changes that we talked about in the movie industry and talked about in the music industry and talked about in newspapers. Understand what's going on. Look to other institutions. Ask your institutional research office. Not only study what's going on now, but what future trends are likely to be. Those kinds of things are terribly, terribly important. I found I was a college and university president for 19 years. And I found out that I moved from the day I took office from being a forest expert to becoming a xylem expert, which is to say, I moved from forest to trees to leaves, to the innards of leaves such as xylem and phloem. Because you're so busy dealing with all these now issues, it's important to have time to look forward. And for me, I had a very fortunate career. I alternated between doing research and doing administration. So sort of when I finished doing enough research and was ready to go back and try it all, and go into a presidency and try that. I've always looked for presidencies in broken organizations. One of the advantages, my first presidency was an institution that was in deep trouble and in danger of closing. And therefore, I could bring all my curricular ideas. And that was wonderful. When I went to Harvard after that, it turned out the program that I took on was having real problems. And I got to remake the program. Then when I went to Teachers College, they'd been running deficits for forever. And the faculty were scared. And then when I went to the Woodrow Wilson Foundation, what I essentially told their board was, close it. You've done great work, but now you're following dollars. And instead, they gave me the job and said, let's stop following dollars. And had a chance to remake a foundation. Those are great opportunities, but everybody doesn't like doing those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, the number of university presidents or vice chancellors that take time out to study their world and write books about it is quite limited. I know only too well from my own time in university executives that you open an awful lot of conferences, you close quite a few, but getting to spend a concentrated period of time really immersing yourself in subjects and learning and listening to others is overrun by the pressures of a diary. But you've found a way of doing that, and you've extended it to, as you hinted at there, with newspapers and the music industry and other parallel sectors. Your analysis in your book is completed by these lessons from the side or from disruptions that have occurred in other sectors. Your book is so rich with examples and lots of ideas that people.
You are very, very kind. I could
But
listen to you all day.
well, I mean it. I couldn't put the book down. And in a 45-minute, 1-hour podcast, we can barely do justice to all of the value and the depth that's in the book. But summarize to encourage people to read more, what you believe the lessons were from the book when the book was written about what universities can learn from other sectors and how that might influence change that we face.
Okay, so the three sectors we looked at, as I mentioned, were music, they were film, and they were newspapers. Three knowledge organizations. They're all forced to change more quickly than higher education and face the same challenges. So what happened was basically all of them came of age during the Industrial Revolution. And their business model came of age during that period, much like higher education did. And they did pretty well. They managed to deal with competitors, other newspapers, television, radio. They dealt with all of those things. They managed to deal with the courts, which tried to stop monopolistic practices. They did just fine with new technologies that emerged during the industrial era. They adopted them when useful. And they held on to their model, their financial model throughout. The thing they didn't count on, and to this extent, it's like reading the same story three times. What they didn't count on was the digital revolution. The film industry never saw Netflix coming. The music industry never saw Apple Music coming. And the consequence was that their model was overturned. They were disrupted. And the lesson for higher education is that could be us. There are new models of higher education that are emerging. And there are, I mentioned an organization called Coursera, which is an online platform for online courses that has from the best universities, the best businesses, and the best museums, libraries, etc. It offers courses. When higher education enrollments in the United States were shrinking during the pandemic, their enrollments increased extraordinarily. And they became six times the size of the higher education industry in the United States. And they're still offering courses. They were the first to provide courses on COVID. They were the first to provide courses in AI. They have nearly 4,000 AI courses. They offer degrees in AI. They offer certificates in AI. That's who they're really competing with.
Yes.
And if higher education doesn't respond, Coursera is our Netflix. Coursera is our Apple Music.
Well, I mean, that's starting to draw towards the conclusion that your book makes, and it does so by doing a really neat bit of synthesis, Arthur. You're thanking me for praising you, but I found the book a delight in the way it took these three different perspectives from the past, from the future, and from the size. and synthesize them into a summary of what the future might hold for global higher education. And you've hinted at it in some of the things that you've said along the way, but how would you summarize that synthesis of what you and Scott were seeing in 2021 about what the future for higher education holds?
In the United States, we have several kinds of higher education. And one form of higher education is research universities and very selective, small liberal arts colleges. And every college in America is going to be affected by the three forces I described. They're going to be affected by demographics, economics, and technology. And for that sector that I just described, they're going to be able to adapt more slowly because they're wealthy and they're prestigious, and they can wait and watch what others do. There are a small sector of institutions that are going to close because of technology, economics, and demographics. And then finally, there's the massive higher education, our two-year colleges and our regional public universities. Those are universities whose names are not familiar to most of the public. And they constitute a majority of higher education. They're going to be disrupted. And they're going to be disrupted by things like Coursera. Their student bodies tend to resemble the Coursera student body. They have students who are part-time. They have students who are first generation. They have students who are working. They have students who are older. Much easier to take those courses sitting at your kitchen table than to drive to campus to have them.
You're being non-ambiguous in your language and in your tone there, Arthur. You seem very clear in how you're seeing the future, and you seem very direct in the advice that you would give to anyone that should listen to that analysis and think about what they should do in response. What should people do if they are currently a university president or assisting a university president or vice chancellor anywhere in the world with the advice that you're giving them?
Well, bear in mind that the advice I'm giving is somewhat unique. It only works in countries that are having similar demographic challenges, that are moving from industrial to digital economies, and that are moving from industrial to knowledge economies. All of that are critical ingredients. But because enrollment was lost during the pandemic, what I've told college presidents to do is scare the hell out of your faculty. Tell them the truth. Tell them what the challenges are they're really facing. And tell them about the risks they're facing, and then invite them to join you in building a new future.
What beautiful advice, Arthur, and what a lovely note to finish on in terms of the contribution that the Great Upheaval book makes to a contemporary understanding of higher education and what people should do with it. This has been a fascinating conversation for me, but I'd love to, in closing, just ask you to say a little bit more about what's next for you and for the Great Upheaval. I think you've got another book in the pipeline. Is that right?
I do indeed. The next book, The Great Upheaval is, for reasons that aren't obvious to me, it's selling even better now than it did before. And Scott and I are busily speaking at conferences, visiting campuses. We figured out in the year and a half after the book was published, or 2 years, we visited 70 different campuses and spoke to leaders in different settings as well. Mm-hmm. And what we decided was, you know, there are some things that have become very, very important. We never wanted to write a sequel. We were done. As a matter of fact, I was halfway through a mystery I was writing, and I really wanted to continue that. But what we realized was we were seeing things we hadn't seen before. And I talked about those issues with you. It's DEI, and it's artificial intelligence, and it's competency-based education. And we had a lot to say about those things from what we'd seen and future directions. And we'd also learned much more about what was working and what wasn't working for colleges and universities in trying to meet the challenges we'd written about. So we decided, okay, let's write this book. And that's what we're doing now.
Well, that's one I'm going to be eagerly looking forward to adding to.
I prefer you read the mystery.
You know what? I'd like to read that too. But look, in the work that you've done, aside from your novel writing, I think you've left us with no mystery about the issues that higher education has faced, and a lot of certainty in a quite uncertain world about the reality of the challenges that loom ahead. But I don't see your work in the great upheaval and in your academic work to date as being a horror story or a tragedy necessarily. It's a story of hope if people can just get on board with the message and manage the transformations that can allow the wave of change to be ridden. Is that how you see it?
Absolutely. Every college, just because I described what will happen if institutions don't act, doesn't mean that that has to happen. For example, community colleges in the United States, which I earlier said are the first destination for most new college students, have had substantial enrollment losses. Well, they can do something Coursera can't do. They can focus on their local community. They can focus on the employment needs. They can focus on its economy. They can focus on the issue that it faces. They can focus on the areas that they need instruction in. Coursera can't do that. And if they do that, and they're inextricably intertwined with their community, how could anything happen but to succeed? There's a story that we'd heard. I visited a place called Amarillo College. The president told me that he built this whole college around this student named Maria. And I was truly doubtful. Presidents see their institutions they want them to be, not as they are. And the next day I went to an orientation for faculty and for staff to start the new year. So the president was talking about Maria. Maria is 24. Maria is has two children. She attends, she's a single mother. She works two jobs and attends college part-time.
Beautiful.
Well, it turns out that's the demographic of this institution. The president got up and described the college in terms of Maria. The faculty senate, the governance body, got up and talked about what they were doing for Maria. The whole conversation all day was about Maria. Can you get more intertwined into your community than they did? Can Coursera compete? Yeah.
That's a beautiful way of taking the sort of concept of a student persona and letting it drive some radical rethinking in our sector, isn't it? And the more we get away from thinking that the only thing we're here for is for 17-year-old school leavers doing 3 or 4 year college degrees full-time on campuses, the more we start to reimagine higher education and its variety and its diversity for the future. And you've given us a lovely example of that.
You put it beautifully.
Well, you've put it beautifully today, Arthur, and I'm really pleased to have met you. I'll give another plug to your book to listeners to this podcast. If anyone after this didn't go and buy The Great Upheaval, they'd be crazy. It's one of the books that I've bought that I've had most pleasure in my decision to purchase. I can't wait to see the sequel, and I will look out for that mystery down the track as well. Dispelling some mysteries and for giving us some clarity on the future of higher education, the HEDX podcast today. Thank you so much for being my guest.
I love being with you, and I'm so glad to have met you.
Likewise, my friend. Likewise. Enjoy your day.
You too.